DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Sarah Steffen. This week we'll talk about culture, dance, music, movies, you name it. Language is an important part of culture as well. In India, a group of people have come together to compile a dictionary, which they say helps preserve the language of Gandhi.
A common language that is there, which has a written script, that there is a kind of oral dictionary, there is a written dictionary, all these things are very important so that this language can survive, so that people can actually study them.
We hear how a dancer in Peru was helping kids turn away from gang violence.
They have no opportunities. In the hoods, it's full of gangs because, of course, they live in a lot of violence. So we work like a family in these places, you know, within the community.
We also have stories about Morocco's dying movie theaters and animated films made in Burkina Faso. Stay tuned for more here on DW's World in Progress. The language of Gandhi is spoken by over 2 million people across 6 Indian states. But despite its many speakers, Gandhi is listed as vulnerable by the UN's cultural agency, UNESCO. Gandhi doesn't have a standard script, and varying dialects have made it difficult for speakers from different states to communicate with each other. That's why Gandhi speakers have teamed up to put together the first Gandhi dictionary. Murali Krishnan went to find out how they are trying to keep the language alive and sent us this report.
Sita Ram Kambli, 35, a farmer from Adilabad in the southern state of Telangana, is pronouncing the word wheat in Gondi, which is being recorded by organizers of Sijinet Swara, a non-profit organization for indigenous communities in the central state of Chhattisgarh. Kambli speaks a variant of Gondi that is only understood in his region.
Page number Moon, Moroka, Moroka.
Then, school teacher Shankar Dasarat Gadekar takes over. He's from Western Maharashtra's Gachiroli district and only speaks Gondi dialect that is only understood by speakers from his area. The two speakers grew up some 200 kilometers or 120 miles from each other and thus speak a different form of Gondi. The Gondi spoken in the state of Maharashtra is known as Marathi Gondi, while the Gondi spoken in Telangana is known as Telugu Gondi. Over time, the language acquired many regional influences and variations. Though Gondi is the second largest spoken tribal language in the country, it also lacks a working script. Gondi is spoken by about 2 million of indigenous people that come from these states, and is the second largest tribe in the country after the Bills, another indigenous community that is scattered around the country. What unites this motley group is their ethnicity. They are all Gonds, and they have set out to generate a shareable Gondi lingua franca that they hope will help forge a common identity for their community. It is for this reason all of them have come together to compile a standardized dictionary. The idea is to distill the various dialects of Gondi, crystallize it, and adopt one standard word list. In the past 3 years, they have held 8 workshops. This time, they come together in India's capital, New Delhi. Over 100 people representing the Gond tribe from 6 states have animated discussions of their language in all dialects. Suklo Singh Ahake, a peasant from the tribal belt of Bethul in the central state of Madhya Pradesh, says communicating with other Gondi speakers is difficult.
There is a big difference in pronunciation, and this can be tricky, which is why we lapse into Hindi.
Subhrangshu Chowdhury is the founder of Sijinet Swara. He's invited these participants purely because all of them share a deep desire to see a working dictionary that will be understood by Gondi speakers.
What we are trying to do here is bringing them together to create a standard language so that administration, journalism and education can start. So from now on, they have now created a standard dictionary. They can have a newspaper, they can have a radio station, they can do administration. So one government order will be understood by all. If there's one teacher, the teacher can go to every corner, which was not possible before.
many of the participants are divided into groups, comprising two from each state to draw up similarities and divergences of the Goan dialects. They come from diverse backgrounds, including school teachers, government officials, farmers, students, and musicians. Though Goan speakers have composed poetry, written plays, and even done movies in Gondi, it is lost among the communities living in different states because the dialects differ too greatly. And in order to be understood by all, many turn to Hindi. Brajlal Thekam is a musician from Madhya Pradesh who has even done musical scores for a couple of movies made in Gondi, specific to Madhya Pradesh. He breaks out into an impromptu song. Brajlal Thekam's song grieves the loss of a mother tongue. Thekam's lament is that Gondi music, specific to every state, will not be understood by all, and thus the necessity for a standard script to connect with the aspirations of the largest forest-dwelling tribal group in India. The oral dialects will live in any case, says Nilanjan Bhaumik, an academic who's closely associated with reviving the Gondi language.
We are trying to, well, not save all the dialect, because that will live on in any case. But a common language that is there, which has a written script, that there is a kind of oral dictionary, there is a written dictionary, all these things are very important so that this language can survive, so that people can actually study them. I don't think linguists, as a matter of fact, have ever studied Gondi or their dialects. If this comes up, this will actually lead to a huge explosion of research in these languages.
According to India's scheme for protection and preservation of endangered languages, there are 780 living languages in India alone. At least 400 are at the risk of dying in the next 50 years. Most at risk are the ones spoken by marginal tribes, whose children receive no education, or, if they go to school, are taught in one of India's official 22 languages instead. Mahendra Kumar Mishra, a language consultant who works with indigenous communities, says globalization plays a huge role.
Not only Gondi, but almost all the regional and the tribal languages are under threat because of the issues of globalization. One language, that is English. If English is to be propagated everywhere and the most non-literate people of this country will think that English can solve all his problems, that is a myth.
So far, 3,000 words have achieved a final standardized form and will be compiled into a proper dictionary soon by the end of the year. The initiative is supported by the Cultural Ministry. An extension of the dictionary into an oral Android application is also on the cards. Murali Krishnan, DW, New Delhi.
It's not just languages that are under threat. In Morocco, it's movie theaters. This North African country that has long been a world-famous location for filming is losing its cinemas. Many of Morocco's once beautiful theaters are disappearing because people prefer to stream movies at home or buy bootleg DVDs. But now, young film students, actors and directors are working towards a renaissance of cinema in Morocco. Inika Mules has this report by Alexander Gube.
Tariq Munim's enthusiasm is palpable. He is standing at the entrance of the Cinema Lynx, one of the great old movie theatres in the centre of Casablanca.
This cinema was built in the 1950s by an Italian architect, Domenico Basciano. He also designed the Lux in Casablanca and the famous Cinema Riff in Tangier.
Lux et le cinéma Riff.
From the outside, the Cinema Lynx appears inconspicuous. But the inside of the theatre is a sight to behold. Around 400 plush red seats, a shell-shaped balcony, a high light blue ceiling, ambient lighting. The entire hall aligned with the big screen. It's like a retro spaceship, which could work as the perfect movie backdrop itself. And yet, this theatre has only just avoided demolition, thanks largely to the efforts of Tariq Munim. With his organisation Save Cinemas in Morocco, the actor works tirelessly to protect the cinema culture in his country.
Cinemas like this one used to be veritable temples of culture. They didn't just show films either. They had plays, dances, staged readings, debates, everything that meant something to culture.
La plupart des salles de cinéma de Casablanca avaient une vocation pluriculturelle.
In the 1980s, there were more than 240 cinemas in Morocco, and more than 42 million movie tickets were sold every year. Now, there are only 29 cinemas left in the entire kingdom. Most Moroccans stay at home and watch downloaded movies, satellite TV, or DVDs, which are often poor quality pirated copies, which are sold on the streets for the equivalent of 50 euro cents. Many old cinemas are now decrepit and run down. In Casablanca, for example, the Lux cinema now resembles a garbage dump with broken windows. The Cinema Liberté is now a cheap supermarket. One of the few remaining gems, in addition to the Lynx, is the Cinema Rialto, a 1930s domed Art Deco building.
There's nothing like watching a good Moroccan movie in a movie theatre which is full of history and tradition, especially a movie from an industry which is experiencing such a boom.
Mounim has organised a screening of the new film Razia from famous Moroccan director Nabil Ayouch at the Lynx Cinema. This is what the Save Cinemas in Morocco organisation is all about, providing a forum for Moroccan cinema and inspiring young people. Mounim wants cinema clubs at schools and lower ticket prices. 6 euros for a single admission is simply too expensive for many young Moroccans. It's a painstaking cinema lobbying project, which doesn't rely on state support, but rather sponsors and like-minded people like Fatima Zahra from Rabat. She has studied film and produced her own photography and short film projects.
In my generation and also in the next, there are so many young people who are incredibly creative, who want to express themselves artistically, even through film. But how can this be done when there's no funding, when there are fewer and fewer cinemas? If these places are missing, where can we show our work?
Without cinemas, there will be no creative newcomers in the industry, she says. Adding, rescuing movie theatres has nothing to do with nostalgia, but with protecting culture.
Ineke Mules with a report by Alexander Goebel. And we stay with the topic of film. You may have heard of big-name animation studios like DreamWorks, Disney and Pixar. Have you ever heard of animation made in Africa? A small animation studio in Burkina Faso is trying to put African cartoon movies on the map. Bram Postumus met the people behind the project. His report starts off with a bit of sound from Paul Wheat, an animation film they created.
Paul Wheat.
Very early every morning at 5 o'clock, children get out of bed with only one goal, to switch on the television and watch cartoons. And everything these children see, sadly, comes from Japan, France or the United States.
That's Wilfried Paré, the coordinator of ABCA, the Burkina Faso Association of Cartoon Cinema. He and a few friends set up ABCA in 2009 with the aim of creating a film industry with an unmistakable signature, that of Burkina Faso, or Africa, if you like. Why?
We think it's our job to add products that answer to the demands that exist here in Africa, because we have beautiful stories to tell, beautiful landscapes, and a beautiful way of looking at the world.
For the last 8 years, Wilfried Paré and his friends have been trying to put animated films from Burkina Faso on the map. With little or no money and only piecemeal international backing, but with plenty of ideas. Olodrisa Kambu is a specialist in building animated designs.
Par exemple, Pawit, je sais qu'il y a l'architecture de Tiebele.
In one of our films, which is called Pawit, we deliberately feature a specific architectural style we call Jibaliya. Even tourists come here to see it. And it's immediately clear that we're in Africa.
Andre Daniel Tapsoba is another specialist who, along with Olodrisa Kambu, has been training scores of young men and women in the fine art of creating cartoons.
We dress our characters in traditional clothes, what we call faso danfani. It's another way in which we want to make sure that our cartoons look different from the rest and are distinguished.
The film Pawit, named after its main character, is a tale of village intrigue set in Burkina Faso's endless savanna. It is one of their better-known productions. Afro Games, a fast-moving film featuring traditional African sports, is another.
Toi, tu ne vois que l'équipe et le fait que tes amis ont des problèmes.
Mais les régionales sont dans deux semaines. En tant que capitaine,
Je me rappelle très bien que pour Afro Games, déjà même pour les personnages, on nous avait demandé un style un peu occidental.
For Afro Games, we were asked to adopt a slightly Western style. For instance, in the choice of our main characters. We refused, because this production is aimed at an audience that is familiar with our reality.
Wilfried Pare points at the biggest problem besetting the industry he and his friends hope to set up, money. Making a cartoon film is an extremely lengthy process involving dozens of people. They create the landscapes, the buildings, the music, the characters, their clothes. And then there are others who voice the film, and still others who make sure that the moving designs and the sound are synchronized. One full-length film can cost as much as 3 million euros to make, they tell me. That's more than the Ministry of Culture spends on film in an entire year. As Wilfried just pointed out, foreign donors come with their own agendas. And so ABCA remains, for now, with little money but plenty of creativity, never short of ideas. Their drive remains the same. Put African animation on the map and ensure that Afro Games, Bataki and Pawit become household names like Shrek, Chicken Little or indeed Titeuf, the raucous French adolescent. Now, one more question, gentlemen. Where are the women? Wilfried Pare replies.
Pour les faire venir dans les formations, nous avons de sérieuses difficultés.
We have tried to get them on our training sessions. We set a minimum quota of 25%, but it was very difficult. It seems they don't see the point of making cartoon films, but we want to get them interested, because the funny thing is, the few we did manage to get involved turned out to be better than the boys.
Wilfried Pare ending that report by Bram Postumus. You're listening to DW's World in Progress with me, Sarah Steffen. Online, we're at dw.com/worldinprogress. You can also listen to us on iTunes or SoundCloud. And check out DW Global Society on Facebook. When we return, we'll hear about the transformative power of dance, helping kids in Peru turn away from gang violence. Now, onto the power of dance. Vania Macias gave up her career as principal dancer in Europe to help disadvantaged kids in Peru. It all started after she saw a group of talented young acrobats performing stunts at traffic lights in Peru's capital, Lima. The power of dance helped transform the lives of some 100,000 children. By teaching them hip-hop dance, she shows them a different path in a tough neighborhood. Dimitri O'Donnell met Vania at one of her dance studios.
Dancer Vania Macias and her students hit the dance floor for another session at her studio in central Lima. The boys are dressed in brightly colored vests, shorts, hoodies and high-top trainers. Most of them are in their early 20s, but 39-year-old Vania is well able to keep up. The young dancers seek out her approval as they try and perfect the tricky steps. 13 years ago, Vanya set up these dance schools to try and bridge the gap between Peru's rich and poor.
I come from a background where I had education, I had private education, I had everything I needed. Actually, in order to go to school, I had a chauffeur, I had a person that took me. And that's when my concern started, no? I never understood why I had a chauffeur, and I saw some kids in the streets working instead of going to school. That was one of my first concerns when I was like 11, 12 years old. Why? Why I have all this? And there's people like me that have nothing in my country, in the same city that I live in.
Vanya is known as one of Peru's top social entrepreneurs. She's attracted a lot of attention because of the success of her dance and leadership schools. Dance, especially ballet, has been a big part of Vanya's life since her childhood.
I started with acrobatics when I was 3 years old. But I got scared when I was 6 years old because I was doing a flip and I fall down. And so my parents, they said, okay, you're going to try ballet. But I hated it. Because imagine doing flip-flops and, you know, big jumps and turning to pliés, grand pliés, and feel that I fall in love when I touch the theater for the first time, you know? It was like making magic real for me.
After reaching the top of her profession in Peru, Vanya left Lima for London and in the process ditched Swan Lake for hip-hop. But it wasn't all plain sailing. Vanya was turned down at most casting calls in London. Dealing with rejection was something new, but Vanya says it helped her appreciate the ups and downs her dancers go through at auditions.
I wanted to explore, you know, another stuff, get deeper, you know, and to discover what dance can give me. So I decided to go and to try, and it was very hard. It was no after no after no after no. That was very hard for me. It was very, very hard, actually.
In 2004, Vanya returned to Peru for a holiday. One day, sitting in traffic, something unusual caught her eye.
That was when everything changed for me, because every day I was going to the theater, which is downtown Lima. And in my way to the theater, I met these guys doing acrobatics in the middle of the streets. That's when my story makes a change.
Vanya didn't just change her life, she turned it upside down. She quit her job as principal dancer with Ballet Ireland and moved back to Lima to try and help the disadvantaged. She set up the D1 dance school and put out a casting call in one of Lima's poorest neighbourhoods. She expected only a handful of kids to show up.
There were more than 100 kids, you know, waiting for me. Why they were believing in me, you know? And I was also a girl, and they were all boys, actually. There were no girls in that audition. And I thought, if I teach them contemporary or ballet, they are never going to come. So I have to pick a language that is going to be attractive for them. So I said, I'm going to pick hip-hop. And I thank so much all those hours that I spent in Pineapple Studios in London when I had free time, and I said, you know, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try some hip-hop, some popping, some locking with Jimmy Williams here in Pineapple, you know? And I said, you know, and this funky music, and it's going to be easier with them because they're in the middle of the streets. They were doing some breakdance also. So I said, you know, it's going to be perfect. And also the hip-hop culture is a culture of peace, and it's a culture of respect.
Vanya targeted areas with few resources, high crime rates, and an embedded drug and gang culture. She wanted to show the children they could choose a different path.
They have no opportunities. In the hoods, it's full of gangs because, of course, they live in a lot of violence. Usually, 98% of them, they live within violence and domestic violence. And that's why gangs work so well, because you belong. They feel like they are in family, and then if you want to stay in the family, then you have to kill, you have to do this and that. Well, D1 works like that, but in the good way. So we work like a family in these places, you know, within the community.
¿Te gusta esta música?
Sí, ¿quieres crear un coreo con eso?
Podría ser.
One of those young recruits is Eddie Revilla, who comes from a tough neighborhood in Lima. He joined Vanya School when he was 13 and says dance has changed his life.
Before, I couldn't even look people in the eyes. I was very shy and introverted. I didn't have much to do with people. I was afraid because of the violence in our society. It's very risky here in Lima. I believe that D1 and dance changed my life. It gave me a sense of security, which is what I needed. I confronted my fears. So this is what dance has done for me.
Enfrentar mis miedos. Eso para mí, la danza me ayudó mucho.
Eddie used to spend his days out on the streets in the baking sun doing acrobatic stunts for bored drivers at traffic lights. He was earning good money, as much as $100 a day, but there were risks.
Pasa el semáforo a verde y corres el riesgo de que un auto...
Once those traffic lights turned green, the cars came speeding towards you, and they could hit you. Sometimes a robber would come and take everything you'd earned that day. They've stolen from me. I was involved in a car accident. These are the kinds of things that endanger your life on the streets, but we do it because we need the money.
Eddie is now living his dream and is a leading member of D1's professional dance company. He's passing on his skills to the next generation of Peruvian dancers. And like Vanya, he believes that dance has the power to transform lives.
I come from a place that's very dangerous. I have many friends that are in jail right now, or are dead, because of drugs. Everybody has a choice, and I made the decision to change my life. Here at D1, they value you and your work. They give you opportunities, but obviously you have to earn them and keep on training. Everyone has dreams, but they shouldn't just stay in the bedroom. You can realize your dreams. You live your dreams day to day, and I believe that you can achieve them by just believing in yourself.
Día a día, yo siento que tienes que valorarse uno mismo.
Migrant families make up 80% of Lima's population, but in the past, the dancers played down their Peruvian heritage because they thought it wasn't cool enough. But Vanya encouraged them to embrace their roots by fusing traditional Peruvian and urban dance styles.
We have a big problem, and it's an identity problem. So when I started with hip-hop because everything that came from outside was better than the inside. But after 1 year, I decided to change the music and just do the hip-hop steps or the house steps or the jazz steps, but do it with our music because it was the same rhythm. So if you see our presentations today, they are all a fusion of what we are as Peruvians, which is we are globalized, we're open to the world, we're receiving all the information that comes from other techniques, but we give value and a lot of value to our own culture, you know?
Vanya's enterprise has expanded and she's opened new schools in the Peruvian cities of Ica and Trujillo. Her next big plan is to take the D1 program into state-run schools so she can reach hundreds of thousands of new children. Do you personally believe you've saved lives, saved children?
I think they changed their life. I gave the opportunity, but they decided. So we broke a big wall between the snobbish girl that comes from a nice place, like me, to a boy that comes from Ventanilla that has nothing. So there's no discrimination. We're just dancing in the middle of a circle, being ourselves and be true to each other. So we're not lying. We're saying who we are with the good and with the bad. And we love each other with that.
For DW in Lima, Peru, I'm Dimitri O'Donnell.
And that's our show for this week. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or find us on iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks very much for tuning in from all of us in the studio, Celestine Wasike and Gerd Georgi. I'm Sarah Steffen and this was World in Progress. Bye for now.